York City, this is Film Spotting's streaming video unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Coming up on this week's show and every other week's show are picks for what's worth watching in the world of streaming and on-demand movies.
Later in our Listener's Choice review, Matt and I explore the power of shrimp as we take on Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie.
Shrimp! But first, we'll offer up our listings of new, notable, and expiring titles on Netflix Watch Instantly and other streaming and VOD services. This is Q-Shots.
Now, this week is Valentine's Day, and so we're starting off our first category at one we're going to call unhappy Valentine's Day movies. These are films that are not at all romantic, that are actually totally inappropriate if you're looking for something to, you know, watch while with your sweetheart.
That's right. However, if maybe you're spending Valentine's Day alone or you're just a misanthrope, we have you covered.
Yeah, indeed. And really, there's very little to find that's romantic in my pick, which is Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, the 2008 documentary from Marina Zenovich, and a really well-made film about the director Roman Polanski, about his sexual misconduct case based around him giving booze and drugs and then having sex with a 13-year-old girl in Jack Nicholson's house. And then the case that followed and that ended with him fleeing the country. And it's a really well-made and very smart film that focuses its attention a little more on what followed the incident, while not, you know, going soft on it in any way. It really looks at the ridiculous media circus that happened, and in particular the judge who was assigned to oversee the case, who was more interested in the position of kind of power and attention he had than in really seeing justice done.
It's fairly even-handed. It's almost like impressively kind of even-handed. It doesn't condone what he did, but it also acknowledges the flaws in the justice system's prosecution of Polanski.
Yeah, and it does weave in some footage from his films like Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown in a really interesting way that just adds to this portrait of an extremely imperfect man, and then also of just the ridiculousness of the era and what happened.
Roman was totally exceptional. Already an established film director, everybody knew him.
He was the Roman Polanski.
The future was his, we thought, and then everything just collapsed.
He didn't perceive having intercourse with a 13-year-old girl is against the law.
The fact of Polanski leaving the country seems to have eclipsed what actually happened to the system of justice.
The judge was enjoying the publicity, and he didn't care about what happened to me, and he didn't care about what happened to Polanski.
So that's on Hulu, and I don't have an expiration date for it. Hulu doesn't seem to make that easy to find, but it's there free in Hulu, so it's one that you should definitely take a look at.
Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. And if it's possible to find an even more grumpy representation of humanity, I found it on Netflix, and it's a film from 2006 called Art School Confidential, directed by Terry Zwigoff, and written by Daniel Clowes. That's the director and writer of Ghost World. This was their sort of pseudo-sequel, I suppose. It's based on a short comic story by Daniel Clowes, which was more of a series of observations about the hypocrisy and stupidity of art school. The film's narrative is basically unique to the film. The narrative was built for the film, and it's kind of an amazing one. Max Minghella, the son of the late director Anthony Minghella, plays Jerome. He's a college freshman. He's majoring in art. And the film is basically about the absolute and surprisingly fast destruction of his idealism, of his love of art, you know, his desire to be a great artist, thanks to the impressive efforts of his untalented fellow students and moronic professors.
I don't have any particular wisdom to impart to you people, except to say this, these four words: don't have unrealistic expectations. If you want to make money, you better drop out right now, go to banking school or website school, anywhere but art school. And remember, only one out of 100 of you will ever make a living as an artist.
There's also a very incongruous subplot involving a serial killer on campus named the Strathmore Strangler. I think it that alone probably turns a lot of viewers off. This was not a well-loved movie by many people. I have a very soft spot in my heart for it.
You've been a great supporter of it.
I'm a big supporter of this movie. I was very excited to see it pop up on Netflix Instant. The movie is undeniably gangly and unshapen. Now, you could argue, if you were so inclined, that some of the rougher edges, especially in terms of the story and that weird subplot, make the film resemble a student film in some ways, maybe intentionally. I think that if you look past the artifice, though, what you see is it's a very, very truthful film and very funny satire of the art world. And if you're dead inside, like I most certainly am, I think you will enjoy Zweigoff's, you know, worldview. If you saw his film Bad Santa, if you found that very dark take on humanity amusing, as I always have, I think you will like this one. I think it will strike maybe an even deeper resonant chord inside the void where your soul should be. Also, proof that Nick Swardson, a.k.a. Bucky Larson, can be funny. Very good in a small supporting role in Art School Confidential. Plays Jerome's roommate, who is gay and doesn't yet realize it. Brilliant performance. John Malkovich, maybe my favorite John Malkovich performance of all time in this movie as one of his professors. A bold statement, I know, Allison, but I'm going to go out there. Also, I didn't rewatch the whole film to get ready for this podcast, but I did take a couple of glimpses at scenes. I completely forgot Adam Scott is in this movie as the returning hero student who has come back to campus to sort of dazzle the audience with his fame. One of the students during the Q&A portion just says that the New York Times has called his work, quote, an expedition into the far contours of an evolving technoculture.
Yeah, I know you always really like this film. It's one that I found a little too cynical, but it's definitely one that is unsparing in skewering the art world. It doesn't take it easy on anyone.
No, certainly not. So that's Art School Confidential. It's on Netflix. It's on there through the end of 2012.
Now, it wasn't my intention, but actually all of the films I picked are the kind of anti-romantic or dealing with...
Do we have to have an intervention, Allison? We have to talk about something?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, I'm all about the anti-romance this week. So the next film, I'm going to call this Film to Remind You That the Classics Can Help You Deal with Heartbreak. And it is Sita Sings the Blues, a 2008 animated film. It's written, directed, and almost entirely animated by Nina Paley. And if you know how long animation takes, then you know how kind of insane and personal a piece of art this is, because it is not easy to animate a feature film by yourself. And this is a film that weaves together the Ramayana, the music of jazz age singer Annette Hanshaw, and the story of the end of Paley's marriage into this really interesting combo that uses different styles of animation and doesn't perfectly fit all the stories together, which is part of what I think is very good about it, is that it lets them kind of like ping off one another. And in the kind of present day story, it follows how the director is living happily with her husband in San Francisco. He takes a job in India for 6 months, becomes very distant while he's over there, while she tries to, you know, stay in contact with him and call him. She eventually goes out there to see him, and basically that he is kind of done with her. And their marriage just kind of peters away. And she looks for parallels in this story of Sita, who is, you know, the wife of this character in the Ramayana who was kidnapped. And when she goes back to her husband, he can never really accept that basically she's still pure and faithful to him, even though she, you know, reassures him of this all the time. And it's about her... the fact that even though he might trust her that she's unsullied, that he can't even deal with the fact that other people might think that she is.
What a beautiful golden deer. Oh, Rama, won't you capture it for me?
The styles of animation, and particularly in the depictions of Ramayana and then in the depictions of there are three people who are interviewed who are portrayed as kind of like puppets, and it takes their descriptions of the stories and kind of draws those as well. They're really unique and just visually just so kinetic and lively, and then the music is amazing. So this is a great, interesting, and very, I think, unusual film. I don't really have another context for it, but it's one that's definitely worth looking for, just because it's also so very personal.
I never got to see this one. I remember when it was started playing the festival circuit, got great reviews, and then I vaguely remember there was some sort of snag with releasing it theatrically. I don't remember what happened
she had,
there.
I think,
don't remember what happened
she had,
there.
I think, music licensing issues, because it depends so heavily on these songs, and I think that there were issues also dealing with, you know, Annette Hanshaw didn't write all of the songs she sang, and so she actually, Nina Paley released it under a Creative Commons license. She just put it out on the web. So you can find this film on YouTube, as well as Hulu, for free. And I think that there are other places that you might be able to download it from her website as well. So she's kind of released it into the wilds of the internet, and I think raised a lot of her money just with donations, with people just, you know, saying, I love this film, and giving money. So it's also a particularly unique piece of art in that way of not like a kind of DIY film. Mm. So it's really interesting, and it's pretty neat.
Okay, great. Well, that segues quite nicely into my next choice, which I describe as the ultimate DIY DVD special feature. And it's called Raiding the Lost Ark, a Filmumentary. This is a brand new filmumentary, I suppose, by director Jamie, or editor, I'm not sure, I guess director and editor, I suppose, Jamie Benning, who's kind of created his own little niche genre on the internet of these things he calls filmumentaries. Have you seen any of them, Allison?
I have not.
Basically, what he does is he takes a film, the original film, and then he cuts in and out of behind-the-scenes footage, and he'll mix in audio interviews and commentary, and it's basically like the ultimate kind of behind-the-scenes, like, DVD special feature of something. So he started doing the original Star Wars trilogy. The new one, as the title suggests, is for Raiders of the Lost Ark. Obviously, he's interested in George Lucas for some reason. I own Raiders of the Lost Ark on DVD. I've watched all the special features on there, but this is, like, the ultimate special feature because it combines all the stuff on that disc with archival footage that I don't really know where it was from, you know, behind the scenes, home movies, promotional featurettes from the 1980s. He animates clips from the original Raiders of the Lost Ark Marvel comic book and puts them into the film. So, like, where there's a deleted scene, perhaps, if the scene wasn't shot for the film, but it was in the comic book, he'll put the scene in and explain what happened. He draws from original story meeting transcripts between Lucas and Spielberg and Kasdan. It's just all this incredible information. If you're an Indiana Jones fan, you'll just love it. It's just absolutely fascinating. I sat there riveted through the whole thing. His website is filmumentaries.com. You can find the new one, Raiding the Lost Ark, there. You can also find the earlier ones about Star Wars there. You can also find some of these on IndieWire's blog, Press Play, and a few other websites. So it's called Raiding the Lost Ark, a Filmumentary. I think he just released it last week by Jamie Benning. Very cool. If you're an Indiana Jones fan, it's definitely something you're going to want to check out.
And at that moment, to stop them, scream that out. Because
they're starting.
Louder.
They're starting.
Right, louder.
They're starting. They're starting.
Great, twice is great.
They're starting. They're starting.
I want to check that out. I think I will. All right, so my last pick here is, let's call this Film to Reassure You That No, You Shouldn't Start Dating Again.
Man, taking it to such a dark place, Allison.
I don't know how this happened. It was not intentional. Anyway, The film is Audition, the 1995.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
It's a film.
I'm just imagining a date right now. Sorry to interrupt you. Somebody, you know, like a first Valentine's date, and it's like, let's watch Audition. Yeah, let's see what happens.
It has to be one of the worst potential films to watch on a date. It's probably the most highly regarded film from the very prolific Japanese director Takashi Miike, who turns out kind of an astounding number. He has a recent and really fun film called 13 Assassins that's also on Netflix watch instantly right now and is also worth checking out. And, you know, his output has ranged from, like, these weird westerns to kids films to horror. But Audition is probably his most coherent work. There are times when you watch his films where you feel like you can kind of almost feel his attention drifting 2/3 of the way through, where
he's already thinking about the next project.
Yeah. But Audition is a really haunting and very disturbing film about a middle-aged widower whose son encourages him to start dating, and his friend, who's a film producer, sets up a fake casting call so that he can meet women, basically, that he can listen to these women be interviewed and choose one to go on a date with. And he does. He finds this woman named Asami, who is a former ballerina who gave up dancing because of an injury. And she seems like this very, you know, very kind of modest, feminine, vulnerable creature. Then we see, I think, in this, like, the most famous shot, we see when he finally decides to call her, that she lives in an empty apartment, and she's just sitting in the middle of the floor looking at the phone. Like, she's been waiting for him to call this whole time. And then from off the screen, you see that there's like a sack and it's moving. And then, you know, he calls and she picks up and is like, oh, you know, I didn't expect you to call. And things go, you know, much darker and weirder from there, including there's a very, you know, the ending involves a wire saw. And it is really, it's violent and troubling, but it is also almost this, like, it's almost this weirdly feminist revenge angle, in that, you know, he wasn't truthful to, like, to her in the beginning about how they met, and it's almost that it's this story that he almost imagines of, like, how he would be punished, all of these fears of getting back into the dating scene, like the worst possible nightmare happening. So that film is Audition, and it is available on Netflix until June 20th of next year. So
okay.
One to look for.
Mine, not exactly a, you know, like a one to make you and your date swoon and fall into each other's arms, but it's a little lighter at least. This one I'm going to call a movie to select your own ending for. And it's 1981's Stripes, directed by Ivan Reitman. This film is available on Crackle.com. Crackle, if you've never used it, it's a free website. They have films and television shows. The selection isn't amazing, and there are commercial breaks in there, which can be frustrating, but free is free. The film is also currently available on Netflix, but it's actually expiring on March 1st. So after that date, you're going to have to look for it on Crackle, I guess. The film is from mostly from the same creative team as Ghostbusters, Ivan Reitman, Harold Ramis, as well as Bill Murray. It hasn't become the same sort of cross-generational kind of immortal classic the way Ghostbusters has. I was informally asking people online, have you seen Stripes? Because I wasn't sure if it was obscure enough to bring up sort of on the podcast, and I was checking, because when I was a kid, I felt like it was almost like a rite of passage movie, like everyone saw Stripes, but talking to people online, it doesn't actually seem like it's maintained that lofty kind of perch, I guess. It's a little more obscure now, so worth bringing up. Bill Murray and Harold Ramis play buddies, and they look up and realize that they're almost 30 and they're wasting their lives, which is kind of horrifying for me because A, they look more productive than me, frankly. And B, I'm older than they are right now than they were in the movie, which definitely led to some soul searching and crying in the shower for me. But anyway, they're broke and directionless. They decide to enlist in the army, which is a very different decision in 1981 than it is now. Let's say that. And the fact that the army is kind of obsolete at that point in time is somewhat of the joke in the film. And the reason I'm selecting it in this case, and why I think it's a very good film to watch, you know, as a streaming film, is, as I was alluding to in my little category there, Stripes is kind of famous or infamous for its legendarily distended running time, which is only an hour and 45 minutes, but a full half hour longer than it really should be.
It feels really long.
It feels really long. There's also, I think on DVD, not on streaming, there's an extended cut, which is like 2 hours long, which is insane. But it's about these lovably untrainable misfits learning to be good soldiers, and it all builds to the big graduation ceremony where Bill Murray inspires the rest of the platoon to kind of man up, and in this speech that's hilarious and genuinely inspiring at the same time. And as I was looking at it again, weirdly evocative of Clint Eastwood's Super Bowl halftime commercial speech in some weird way.
So we're all dog faces. We're all very, very different. But there is one thing that we all have in common. We were all stupid enough to enlist in the Army. We're mutants. There's something wrong with us. Something very, very wrong with us. Something seriously wrong with us. We're soldiers. But we're American soldiers. We've been kicking ass for 200 years. We're 10-1.
And then at the actual graduation, he leads them in the big, you know, like, razzle dazzle in Army training and all that good stuff. And that right there feels like it should be the climax of the movie. It's certainly the emotional climax of the movie. But then for some reason, they added this whole extra subplot where they go to Italy and there's Cold War and, you know, like machine gun violence and all this kind of crazy stuff. And so, you know, you're on Crackle or Netflix Instant, I would say. You could probably stop the movie right after the graduation.
Yeah, I would agree.
And you won't be missing anything. And before the graduation or right up until the graduation, it's great. The other reason I think this is a really good moment to rewatch or watch for the first time Stripes is I think it will make for fascinating discussion fodder for another movie that's about to open, Allison. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's called Act of Valor. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of it.
It's opening on February 24th. So I guess right before we'll speak to you guys again on the next episode of SVU. This movie, Act of Valor, is about real active duty Navy SEALs reenacting missions on camera, sort of almost like turning real life into fictional adventure kind of thing. And I just think when you compare, as I was saying, like the way that what the Army meant in 1981 with what it means now in 2012, I feel like if you go see Act of Valor, that will make a really interesting point of conversation. So you can arm yourself with some good discussion talking points if you see Stripes now. So it's on Netflix until the end of the month. And then after that, go check it out on Crackle.
All right. And I have one more, an anti-recommendation.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, that's never happened before.
I know. But
it's a new thing.
Because I was looking at a film that I was considering to recommend to talk about. And then I realized it was a dubbed version. And that film is Shaolin Soccer, and which is, you know, a film that I otherwise really enjoy from Stephen Chow and like a great time. But the version that's on Netflix is, for whatever reason, the dubbed version, and it's really not even very well dubbed. So if you see it pop up on Netflix, I would say just, you know, look for the DVD, because there's no reason to watch it. Just kind of like it's so bad. The dub is so bad.
A recommendation
actually,
to avoid.
Yes.
Okay.
It actually gets in the way
of
the movie.
Okay. Well, now's the time on the show where we tell you what films are expiring on Netflix. This is the segment we call Behind the Eight Ball. All right, I guess I'm going to start, and I will give you... Now, last week on the show, the first show, we gave you movies that were expiring, and we didn't give you much time to watch a lot of them. They were right up against the first day that we released the show, and some listeners wrote in to the feedback address and said, hey, you know, this isn't enough time to watch the movies, which is that's a fair point. So what we've decided to do is this segment, the Behind the Eight Ball segment, we're going to give you a few weeks. So, like, this show goes up on the 13th of February. So we're going to give you at least a week from when we've launch the show to expire. So all the movies from now on are going to be like a week or two ahead of time, so you can put them in your queue and get to them before they expire. So I'm going to start. We each give you five movies here. My first one expires on February 28th. It's The Lady Eve, a classic Preston Surge's screwball comedy that stars Barbara Stanwyck and Henry Fonda, a delightful, hilarious movie. Check that one out if you've never seen it. There's a whole bunch of Alfred Hitchcock films. They went up at the beginning of February, and they're going to be gone on February 29th. They include Vertigo, the immortal classic, of course, The Trouble with Harry, which I find to be a very charming, one of his more lighthearted comedy films, even though it's about a dead body. And then one of my all-time favorite underrated Hitchcocks, which is Frenzy. It's one of his later ones. I think it's his last, like, masterpiece movie. A really, really good movie. Very interesting way that he plays with audience identification in that movie. So they all expire, in that case, on February 29th, all three of those titles. Also expiring on February 29th, if you're in the mood for something a little less good and a little more bad, Battlefield Earth, the immortal camp classic Battlefield Earth, if you've never seen it. I certainly wouldn't recommend paying to see it, but in the world of Netflix streaming, it is a perfect choice for a bad movie night. If you indulge that sort of thing, I definitely recommend it on that level. On March 1st expiring, I've got two action movies to round out my segment here. La Femme Nikita, the Luc Besson classic that inspired an American film, an American television show, another American television show, one of the really the classics of female action movies about a heroin junkie who accidentally kills a cop, basically, and is blackmailed into becoming an assassin, essentially. And her life as an assassin, also balancing her sort of her life as a regular woman as well, trying to sort of it plays with the idea of femininity and trying to be trying to be an independent woman and also having a home life as well in an interesting way. And then for you Sylvester Stallone fans out there, also expiring on March 1st, Cliffhanger, which I caught up with recently while I was doing some research on a writing project, and it holds up pretty nicely actually. The opening sequence of Cliffhanger, even if you just watch the opening sequence, is amazing. It's kind of cliched now. I think it's been parodied on many films. You know, it's like this woman who's like dangling off this cliff and Sylvester Stallone tries to save her and she's like falling. Her harness is slowly breaking inch by inch. But the photography in this sequence on top of a mountain looking down these, and it looks like somebody is really dangling there, is just spectacular. And it will make you, even if you're not afraid of heights, but you know, it's, you just imagine yourself in that position, it will make your palms sweat. The photography is so good in that Rennie Harlan classic Cliffhanger. So those are my movies: The Lady Eve, Frenzy, Vertigo, Trouble with Harry, the Hitchcock triple feature there, Battlefield Earth, La Femme Nikita, and Cliffhanger. How about you, Allison?
All right. Well, my first pick is expiring on February 20th, and it is Smiley Face, which is a great and really unfairly ignored at the time. It came out in 2007, I think, at its premiere at Sundance, from Greg Araki, of all people, not maybe the first person you would think of to make a stoner comedy. Stars Anna Faris as Jane, a would-be actress who mostly just hangs out and smokes pot.
Correct.
And it's a story about how she accidentally gets far too high by eating her roommate's cupcakes. I believe their pot cupcakes. And has this epic day of things going horribly wrong. It's narrated by Roscoe Lee Brown. It's just so strange and so funny and just incredibly often like dark and goes and has a lot to do with looking at how you might look outside when you think things are going well when you're high, and then outside it's just disaster. So that expires on the 20th. And then on the 22nd, Last Train Home, a great documentary that's about workers in China who are living in a city to work and then go home over Chinese New Year to the village they came from where their children are growing up. It's a couple, and they have two children who are being raised out there who they only see once a year. And it just is an amazing film about how a lot of people have moved to the cities and try and make life work in China, from Li Shinfan. And then on the 28th, expiring, is Valley of the Dolls, starring Patty Duke and, you know, speaking of Roman Polanski, Sharon Tate, who was his wife, who was famously and horribly murdered by the Manson family. It's a kind of schlock classic about would-be stars who get addicted to dolls, prescription pills, and then, you know, things go terribly wrong.
This is not Beyond the Valley of the Dolls,
no.
The sequel that had no connection to it by Russ Meyer and Roger Ebert. This is the original.
This is the original.
Right.
And
probably just as funny, I guess.
Right, though I don't think the original was made with the camp quality in mind.
No, that was
unintentional. This one was, it was very serious.
Yes.
on March 1st, Panic Room, a little lesser David Fincher, but still a pretty enjoyable film.
Lesser Fincher is still like superior filmmaking.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a kind of great turn of Jodie Foster, who I think is one of those unsung action heroines, really, and kind of like unexpected in taking up some of these roles. And also on March 1st, The Virgin Suicides expires, Sofia Coppola's first film. And I'd say one that if you're really, you know, if you've never understood why people like Sofia Coppola, this is a... It was an interesting start, and I think in some way it has a lot of thematic similarities to other films she did, but is also unique, based on a book from Jeffrey Eugenides, and it's an interesting film. So that's, once again, Smiley Face on February 20th, February 22nd, Last Train Home, 28th, Valley of the Dolls, and on March 1st, Panic Room and The Virgin Suicides.
in 2012.
I mean to tell you this all night, but I love you, man. I love our friendship.
Thank you. I honor you, and I honor our friendship, and I honor our love.
Two of America's most celebrated icons.
Hi, I'm Eric Wareheim.
And I'm Tim Heidecker.
Oh, yeah!
Present a motion picture so epic.
I want to eat their hearts! Yeah!
Yes! Yes!
It will leave you in shock.
All right, now we move on to our listener's choice section. Now, in our last episode, we offered you three different choices for this week's longer review. Lech Majewski's The Mill and the Cross, Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie, the first film from comedians Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim, and a Paul Verhoeven double feature of Flesh and Blood and Hollow Man. And while it was close for a while, very close actually, between the Verhoeven pairing and Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie, in the end, Tim and Eric won out.
I think it was the budget. I think just the spectacle of a billion-dollar movie, they just...
Yeah, when do you get to see that?
Exactly.
It's astounding.
Yep.
Now, Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie is out on VOD and iTunes right now, and will be in theaters on March 2nd. The comedians are best known for their TV shows Tom Goes to the Mayor and Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job. The plot of the film, if you want to call it that, is that they've been given an unprecedented $1 billion to make a movie by the Schlang Corporation, but they wasted most of it on things like makeovers for themselves. And the corporation demands to be paid back as per their contract, so Tim and Eric take an unlikely and really not very reliable-looking job of trying to clean up this kind of feral, wolf-infested mall called the Swallow Valley Mall. So, Matt, I have not seen Tim and Eric's shows, and actually deliberately kept it that way after we knew we were going to review this movie, just so that I could be the blissfully ignorant one and talk about it from that perspective. But you have seen some of their work. So would you say this film is a good representation of their sense of humor?
Well, yes, I think it is. I have to say, though, I'm not exactly an expert on their work either. I've only seen a couple of episodes. I've seen some of their spinoff show with John C. Reilly, Check It Out with Steve Brule. So I'm no expert either. It does feel like the stuff I have seen from them just blown up to rather distended length. I mean, the thing that's kind of amazing is that not only did they make a feature, they made like a full 90 plus minute feature where their shows are not even half hour shows. You know, that's like they're like 12 minutes. You know, they're less than 15 minute shows. So I thought that was a really surprising and maybe not the best choice for them because they are such small quantities. Their television shows, they're so short that, you know, it's the problem of many TV shows where they try to go blown up to feature length is how do you fill that time? I think the biggest problem with the movie is that it's way too long.
Yeah. It's especially you can feel, you know, I having never seen their work before, you can feel that they're used to working in maybe 2 to 3 minute segments because mm-hmm. the film is filled with a lot of like what would be a standalone 2 to 3 minute segment.
Yeah.
Again and again and again and
right.
again and
well,
again.
Well, that mall that they take over is basically just an excuse to do sketches. Each store is a different sketch. It's a different weird owner. It's a different weird store that sells something that no normal store would sell. And each one is basically a different, you know, comedy bit.
Yeah. And, you know, they also break up the film with things like theme two, understanding the movie, where they have something that offers really no insight into understanding the movie. Or they break up, they have fake commercials or little bits of video that they've made, ads for themselves. I do appreciate their obvious devotion to terrible production values. They are really, they have a great sense of artistry in terms of like weird, you know, weird kind of VHS style, public access style editing techniques and like graphics on screen.
And the artistry of no artistry, basically.
No artistry. Yeah, they're great at picking like the weirdest looking freeze frames for people mm-hmm. or just like cutting on like someone with their eyes half open or making a very strange face.
Yep.
And that, I mean, I do appreciate, though, that's not really enough of a joke unto itself to hang a whole movie on. And they do go to that pretty often.
Right.
We didn't mention there are actually a lot of guest stars that turn up here.
Yes,
some
indeed.
Of them for no particular reason. They just kind of wander in. You've got Zach Galifianakis, Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, Will Forte, Jeff Goldblum in the very beginning, mm-hmm. talking about, which is actually one of my favorite parts of the film.
The Schlang seat.
Yes, it's supposed to improve your experience right. in terms of watching the movie by basically...
Now, here's a great question, though. The Schlang seat, that's the opening. It's sort of, it's almost like Kentucky Fried Movie, where it opens with a bunch of, you know, like commercials or fake little bits before the narrative kicks in. Now, in that case, it's Jeff Goldblum in like selling one of these Schlang Corporation theater seats, which I won't describe. I'll let that joke, I'll let you discover that joke on your own. But it's supposed to be a theatrical theater, like, you know, and the joke, part of the joke is that, you know, warning, your theater may not be equipped with Schlang Corporation seats. But we're watching this at home. That we're not in a theater. It's we're watching this on VOD. Now, does that make the joke less effective or more effective because it's even more absurd because there's no theater at all?
It did seem like an intentional throwback in that way. Okay. It's like finding an old VHS tape somewhere that has ads for TV shows that are like long, long gone that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
It's so out of place that it's almost funny.
Because that's the thing with Tim and Eric's sort of material is that it's very hard to find, like, sometimes the jokes are not obvious. There are jokes.
Or there is no joke.
Right. And it's and some people say, well, they don't make, you know, that it's not funny because they're, you know, there's so much of it is about an attitude, I guess. And that's part of what I did like about the movie in some ways. The film, to me, feels like it was written in an antagonistic fit to studio notes. You know what I mean? Like, you imagine someone writing a screenplay and handing it into an executive, and then the executive saying, well, this won't work. You need the characters to be more likable. And they made themselves, they're the stars playing Tim and Eric, so unlikable, so incredibly unlikable, both to each other and to the other characters in the film. You know, you need to cast big stars. And okay, they have big stars, but some of their roles almost seem intentionally unfunny or, you know, intentionally random. You know, they appear and disappear. You know, you guys aren't exactly the most handsome guys. You need to, you know, maybe, you know, spruce up your look. They have these overly ridiculously Hollywoodized looks with deep fake tans and goatees and, you know, and they keep them for like 25 minutes, even though that joke is over at, you know, after about a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you need a hot young love interest, and they have a middle-aged woman as the love interest. You know what I mean? It's like all of these things. On the other hand, one of the notes they might have gotten was, you need more jokes. And it seems like they may have played against that and said, well, we don't need jokes, especially in the middle of the movie. I found there was a lot of dead air.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I feel like you can violating the rules is funny. But if the rule of a comedy is to be funny, I don't know if violating that rule inherently makes it funny.
Yeah, this film is also antagonistic towards the audience.
Yes.
I think you have to say, like, there are times where this film is almost daring you to walk away. Like, mm-hmm. there is no real forward momentum in terms of, like, plot development at all. It just keeps going. And, as you said, it's basically assembled segments, assembled sketches. And then it ends, like, insanely, and also...
Well, the ending is great, though.
Right, but and then it kind of ends several times.
I had no problem with that.
Well, I found it at times just difficult to watch because there's so little to hold you to the film mm-hmm. that, you know, it deliberately has no characters, and it deliberately has no real arc, and it deliberately, you know, things don't really lead into from one to another. So I thought that... Yeah, it's not that funny. Like, especially in the middle, and I felt like that aimlessness just felt like filler.
Yeah, the one thing I will say, and I agree completely with what you're saying. I thought that the beginning was really funny. I was laughing a lot at the beginning. My wife was in the other room and even commented, like, "What are you watching? That's so funny." And then the ending, I was laughing a lot. And the middle, though, there were times when I was, you know, checking my watch. I was starting to wonder what was, you know, when is this going to get funny again? But here's the other thing I will say in their defense is that it feels to me like a movie that's not meant to be watched on its first viewing. Like, you almost need to jump to the 10th viewing. You know, I feel about this movie in some ways, although I like it less, I feel about it the way I kind of felt about Anchorman the first time I saw it, where I laughed, but I walked out of the theater not feeling like I had seen a masterpiece, and yet here we are 10 years later, and I've seen that movie 50 times. And I almost feel like this is the kind of movie that may have that sort of value, especially the beginning, especially the ending. There's a scene with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly together that I actually rewatched because we had to rent it on iTunes. After the movie's over, I went back, I rewound the movie, and I rewatched that scene two more times because I found it so funny. And that's a case where there's actual jokes. You know, it's not just like anti-funny. There is absolutely some comedic material there.
Yeah, see, it reminded me of Basketball, really. They just in their vibe together, I think that they have actually a very similar vibe to the creators of South Park, and just the way they play off one another. But also in that, I felt like they really... Like halfway through, I was like, I don't think they should be given a movie, actually. Like, I don't think they can carry a movie.
Here's the comparison I made. Actually, somebody else, and I saw somebody else, I forget where, I read a review or saw a review where somebody else made this, and I was like, that's right on the money. It's Freddy Got Fingered. That's to me the comparison to make. We have this guy, you know, Tom Green, who's really only used in working and on television and also, you know, very anti-narrative, and then goes really into a weird place, you know, like takes it to some really strikingly strange and abrasive dimensions. And I would actually say if you liked Freddy Got Fingered, there's a good chance you'll enjoy this, and vice versa. If you found that movie, you know, nonsensical and you didn't get it, I don't think there's much hope for you here. So I think that's actually the point, the closest comparison that I could draw.
Yeah. And do you think that this film should be seen in the theaters?
I will say this. I would recommend the movie, but we paid, what was it, $10 to rent it? It's kind of an expensive rental on iTunes. I don't think it's worth that. I would probably pay half that much to see it, I think.
Right.
So therefore, I guess it's not worth seeing in the theater.
Right.
That would be even more money than that.
I would agree. Well, with that ringing endorsement, Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie is out now on VOD and iTunes, and you can also find it in theaters on March 2nd.
Now it's time to pick next week's Listener's Choice movie. We give you the three options we're interested in discussing. We throw them to you, and we let you decide which movie you want to hear us discuss on next week's show. The first option this week is actually not a movie, it's a television show. It's Netflix's first original, completely original series. It's called Lilyhammer. And it stars Steven Van Zandt. Here's the official description from Netflix, Allison. After he testifies against a mafia boss, ex-gangster Frank Tagliano enters the witness protection program and asks to be sent to Norway, because that's what happens. Despite the peaceful surroundings, it's not long before Frank strays from the straight and narrow. Netflix made a lot of headlines, I guess, last year when they announced that they were doing an original series with David Fincher and Kevin Spacey. That's kind of a big deal. That hasn't happened yet. This is sort of, I think, they're testing the waters with this series to see how it goes. And in an interesting choice, I thought, because they know their customers, and they know that when people watch shows on Netflix, they tend to really binge on them and watch 3, 4, 5 episodes at a time. They made the entire series available all at once when it launched last week. And I think it's about either 6 or 8 episodes. I can't guarantee we're going to watch all 6, 8 hours of this thing.
Right.
But we'll watch more than one. We'll watch 2 or 3 at least.
Yeah.
I think that's fair to say. So that's choice one, Lilyhammer. Choice two, this one was really Allison's choice. It's a film I've never seen, but she has. So she's going to give the pitch for this one. It's In Dreams, the 1999 film directed by Neil Jordan and starring Annette Bening, Robert Downey Jr., and Stephen Ray. Allison, why are you interested in seeing In Dreams again?
Well, I haven't seen it since I think it was in theaters back in 1999, but and beyond the fact that I love Neil Jordan's visual style, and I think he handles this divide between like kind of gritty realism and then this like magical like sensibility, even though it's often very dark, I think he handles that very well. It's also just interesting because it's got Annette Bening as someone whose daughter was kidnapped and murdered, and then, you know, you have Robert Downey Jr. as the man responsible, and then they have this kind of connection, the nature of which is like always a little mysterious, in which she starts to see the murders that he's going to next commit. So I think that it's got a really interesting setup and some interesting performances, including apparently Robert Downey Jr.'s last film before he was sent to prison on drug charges.
How nice.
Yes.
All right. So that's In Dreams on Netflix Watch Instantly. Also on Netflix Watch Instantly, our final choice this week is She's Gotta Have It from director Spike Lee. This is his 1986 film, his first feature film, actually, which neither Allison nor I have ever seen. So this would be a first for us. It seemed like a good time to talk about this one because Spike Lee has a new film.
Right, Red Hook Summer.
It just played at Sundance. He got a lot of attention with that. His post-film rant where he was, you know, railing against Hollywood and their depiction of African-Americans got a lot of attention.
It was a really divisive film also. Like, people were very split either way on whether it was a success or not.
Absolutely. And it's him sort of going back to his roots a little bit. His character from Do the Right Thing appears. It's set in Brooklyn, as She's Gotta Have It is as well. So it just seems like something that this would be a good time to check that one out. We've never seen that one, as I mentioned. So That's our third option. So those are your choices this week. Lilyhammer, the new TV series, In Dreams from Neil Jordan, or She's Gotta Have It from Spike Lee. Now, which movie or TV show should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? That is up to you. Send your pick to feedback@filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll at the right side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, February 20th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on our Twitter account, which, by the way, is twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that next week to watch the film or TV show, I guess. And then join us for the conversation on our next episode, which will be on Monday, February 27th. If you watch whichever movie or show wins and you want to join the conversation beforehand, you can also send us your feedback, feedback@filmspottingsvu.com. FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, which admittedly is not very large yet, obviously, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. So we put up a little like show notes, and we compile all the direct links to all the Netflix and Hulu and Crackle and every website and every specific link we mention. So if you want to find a movie quickly, that's a great place to do that. FilmspottingSVU.com. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and another review. In the meantime, you can follow Allison and I on Twitter, twitter.com/AllisonWilmore and twitter.com/MattSinger. And, of course, you can also follow the show on Twitter, twitter.com/FilmSpottingSVU. That's a great place to find where we announce the winner of the Listener's Choice Review. And I've also been using it to tweet out recommendations for new streaming titles people send to our feedback account, and we put them out there on Twitter. So it's a great place to find some more recommendations. If you have watched all of the movies we've discussed and you're still thirsting for more, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.